Hello, and welcome to Asians Represent. I'm Daniel Kwan.
And I'm Jade Matkesh.
And we're your hosts for this bonus episode.
Today's episode is all about connecting with nature through gaming.
Yeah, it's really awesome. Our featured creator for this episode is Jian Shim. Now, Jian is a survival skills instructor, a LARP designer, and an all-around, you know, awesome human being. This was an amazing conversation. I actually had a technical goof-up that resulted in us losing the first 38 minutes of the interview. It would have ended up being a two-hour episode, so maybe it was for the best.
Yep.
But the first 38 minutes, the audio quality isn't quite what we wanted. But we are going to make it available as an exclusive for patrons of the One Shot Network.
And the content was golden.
Oh, the content was great. We talked about, you know, my hate for being called Dan. We talked about wearing shoes in the house.
Mm-hmm.
East Coast versus West Coast Asians.
Mm-hmm. It's a whole thing.
It's a whole thing. It was really good. And so that comedic gold is going to be available only at patreon.com/oneshotpodcast. Now, do we have any news?
Yeah, so, well, you just came back from New York, yeah?
Yeah, I just came back from New York. That was a dope trip. I guess I'll start with me then. Yeah, I just came back from New York. Sarah, my girlfriend and I went to New York. We got to meet up with a couple, actually, RPG people.
Mm.
We met up with our friend Joe DeSimone,
mm-hmm.
Who just started a website called Index, which is all about critical evaluation of RPGs.
Mm. Right, yeah.
Yeah, and it's user-contributed, and it's completely anonymous. So if you have something to say, that's the place to say it.
I remember he posted it on Twitter,
yeah.
The idea. He floated the idea, and the next day, it was up.
It was live, yeah. He works fast, so... you can, it's called Index. If you want to look for it, you can just head to his Twitter. Give him a follow. He's super cool. His Twitter is iHeartFargo. He should make one in his name, but right now it's iHeartFargo. but yeah, I was in New York, met up with Joe, his partner Haley, and then met up with another designer, Ryan Flommer, and his partner Emily. And we met up at this like dim sum restaurant, and it was the busiest dim sum restaurant ever. They had like, you had to take numbers to get in. It was so packed.
Whoa.
But it was banquet hall sized.
And it was amazing?
It was amazing.
Okay.
It was called
worth it.
Jin Fong.
Cool.
Jin Fong. Yeah, it was.
Check it out when you're in New York.
Yeah, check it out. But I think what was most interesting about that trip, and I think most relevant to this podcast, was our visit to the MoCA. That's the Museum of Chinese in America. It's on Manhattan. It's right in Chinatown. Kind of on that border between Chinatown and Little Italy.
Mm.
And they had this amazing exhibition called Radical Machines, Chinese in the Information Age. And it was just the history of the Chinese typewriter.
Mm.
Now, if you've ever looked at like Chinese writing, there's no alphabet. There are like over 70,000 characters in the Chinese written language. And this exhibit was curated, actually, interestingly, by a white guy.
Hmm.
A Stanford historian named Tom Mullaney.
Mm-hmm.
Mullaney? Yeah, Mullaney. And he has the largest collection of, you know, Chinese typewriters in the world.
Whoa.
Yeah. And so he curated this with his personal collection and bits from other donors. And it was really interesting. Like, you know, I kind of take my ability to type in Chinese for granted.
Mm. You can type in Chinese?
Yeah, you can type in Chinese through your smartphone.
Oh, cool, yeah.
Yeah, it's through pinyin, so you can type in like sort of the phonetic.
Right,
English,
you can do that, yeah, in Japanese
can,
as well, yeah.
Yeah, and you can select the Chinese characters.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, it was like, how do you actually create a typewriter with 70,000 characters?
I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah, exactly. So they did this whole exhibition on it, but also the underlying racism that Chinese people face when trying to develop this technology.
Right, yeah.
Because there's this idea that, you know, Chinese people and China in itself was a threat. And so they were viewed as inferior to English and to that typewriter.
And this was developed in America, was it?
No, it was. It's interesting. The whole history is really complicated, but it involves a lot of actually white European inventors going to China to try to help the Chinese people.
Okay, yeah.
But the one you see on that cover, the book called The Chinese Typewriter History by the curator, Thomas Mullaney, That's the double pigeon typewriter. So that has like the most commonly used characters.
And it's massive.
It's massive. It looks like a cutting board.
Yeah, it does.
Like
it
a
does,
paper cutter or something.
But they're buttons.
Yeah, it actually like is like a typewriter, but you manually move the thing around instead of hit keys.
Yeah. That's wild. Yeah.
Yeah, it was wild. It was a really cool exhibition. They also had a section on like the Exclusion Act, on, you know, on like the Dragon Lady stereotype, on chop suey and
right.
like American Chinese stuff.
Yeah.
And then a beautiful black and white photograph display about, you know, Chinese in Manhattan and the Chinatown and growing and like how that Chinatown grew and the experiences of immigrants in New York. It was like an amazing, amazing museum.
And you're saying Thomas Mulaney curated it?
Yeah, he curated the typewriter.
Right, I see.
So that's the rotating exhibition.
Right.
So I reached out to him, and I'm having him on my podcast, Curiosity and Focus.
Oh, cool.
I didn't think it would fit with Asians Represent, but I wanted to talk to him nonetheless. Mm. If I find that it really does go well, maybe we'll just do another interview.
Yeah.
But I feel like we should try to do a collaboration with the people at this museum.
Mm.
Just kind of talk.
Super cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the highlight, you know, other than spending time with my girlfriend.
Right.
that was
eating all the good food.
Eating all the good food. Got to meet one of my pizza idols.
Nice, yeah. Oh, yeah, I saw your photo.
Yeah. Best pizza on Instagram. Yeah, it was just like a really good trip. You know, it was reinvigorating. It was my first vacation in like 3 years.
Oh, nice, yeah.
Yeah, so I...
Congrats.
I really needed that.
Yeah.
But yeah, other than that, I don't have any other news other than we're all going to be at Breakout Con.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Super excited about that.
You, me, Agatha, we're going to be Breakout Con.
Come say hi.
Yeah, March 15th to 17th at the Sheraton Center here in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing a panel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be a live recording of an Asians Represent episode.
Mm-hmm. And we're doing it with Banana Chan.
With Banana Chan. It's going to be dope. I'm really excited for it.
Yeah.
We're going to organize some sort of meetup.
Yeah.
So if you if you're coming to that con, if you want to meet up with us, if you want to hang, I think we're going to do like, we'll do like a big lunch or something.
Mm-hmm. Show you all the hot spots.
Yeah,
around
show you
here.
All the hot spots around City Hall.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh God. we'll find something. But if you want to know about that, you know, give us a follow on social media and you know, give us a like on Facebook, facebook.com/AZNSrepresent. And that's where we'll post the event. Aside from Breakout Con, we have an Instagram now.
Yep.
We're gonna start posting.
We're gonna start posting on that, yeah.
Maybe we'll do it. We'll do it today or something. Mm. We'll do it tomorrow.
Okay. Let's do it. Oh, let's post a selfie from today.
Yeah, let's do that. So give us a follow. That's again at AZNSrepresent on Instagram. But yeah, for me, New York trip, I'm doing some freelance stuff and Breakout Con. I feel like you've got more in terms of like things you're doing right now.
January's been so busy.
Like, I'm just prepping for our weekend game.
Which is a lot of work. Oh, I'm so excited. We're playing Gaslands this weekend, and I just haven't had the chance to look over any of the material, but the chat that we're in has been, like, blowing up. And there's, like, sweet photos of everyone's cars, and I'm way behind.
Yeah, so for the listeners, Gaslands is a game by Osprey Games. It's a skirmishing war game. Basically, there's actually a little bit of narrative behind it. It's the idea is that Mars took over Earth forcefully and that Earth is now being controlled by Martian collaborators and people are being put in these death races called the Gaslands.
So freaking cool.
And so in the game, you basically take like a Hot Wheels car, like those die-cast cars, and you kitbash them using land. You repaint them and you make them look all post-apocalyptic.
Mm-hmm.
You could see photos of my stuff on my Instagram at Daniel H. Kwan. But yeah, we're going to do that. We're going to have our first race. And I think I'm going to try to make it into a monthly thing.
Mm.
And
I hope so.
I hope so, too, with our group. Because we you know, we were playing D&D. You missed out when we played on Coriolis. but we're going to play Gaslands. Because one of the members of our group, Aiden, he's an engineer. And you got to see the car he made. Oh, my God.
Not even going to try.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So we'll post some pictures from that on the Instagram as well. Maybe we'll do a live. We'll see. But yeah, well, you had a busy month and you've got, you know, a lot of things coming up.
Yeah, I've got a number of things coming up. Well, right now I'm prepping for a few lectures that I'm doing next month. I'm speaking at Ryerson on puzzle design, puzzles, process, and innovation.
Ryerson is a university here in Toronto.
And It's for a transmedia storytelling class, and I think it's just so cool that that exists.
That's awesome.
I'm also, the next day, I'm doing a lecture up at Waterloo on Tycho, and I'm really excited about that. Yeah, Daniel is swinging his arms above his head.
like a drummer.
I've inspired him. And aside from that, I'm really excited because I have the opportunity to go to GDC at the end of March.
Yeah, that's going to be dope.
Yeah, I'm really, really stoked. I don't know if anyone's going to be there. Hit me up. I would love to hang out. Yeah.
Yeah, so you're going to do your lecture series,
yep,
Ryerson, Waterloo, and then you're going to GDC.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be doing Breakout Con. I got really hooked on Elder Scrolls Online.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Super hooked.
Yeah.
I made my elf look Asian.
Oh,
really
cool. Yeah.
But we actually got a nice gift in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
So
sweet.
It's so sweet. And it's a cool game, too. So our friend Chris in Austin, shout out to Austin. I love Austin.
Mm.
I went there a couple years ago and I stayed there for a month. It was great. But our friend Chris, he's at Emo Technology on Twitter. Chris Vu Gandon Lee wrote a game. It's an RPG. It's called Party at Tiffany Burrell's House. It's a role-playing game for awkward 90s kids.
Yeah.
It's got the most 90s cover.
I love it, yeah.
Isn't it? It's awesome. Also, we weren't paid for this. I legitimately think this is just cool.
Yeah.
Chris,
I'm super excited to play it, which we should soon.
Oh, we 100% should. Chris sent Agatha and I a PDF of this a while ago, and I read it, and I was like, I love this.
This is the best.
But these photos are great.
Just really, yeah. Really
yeah.
Do it.
So, yeah, this is about being at a party. You just finished your sophomore year of high school and something's happened, something amazing. And you've been invited to the most poppin' of parties, the party at Tiffany Burrell's house. This is dope. This is the kind of game that I think we should play on the podcast.
Yeah, for sure.
If I could get Chris to run it for us.
Oh yeah.
We should record that. That'd be a lot of fun.
That'd be really cool, Chris.
I think if you're an indie designer and you want to, you know, show the world your game, you got a dope game, let us know. Hit us up.
Yeah.
Swords and Flowers, we're going to play Magic Sword.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to try to do something there. And but this, Party at Tiffany Burrell's House, I really want to play this because I want to see how if it plays out like it does in my head.
God, yeah. I'm already like cringing and, I don't know, feeling mixed things about everything.
Yeah.
Super excited at the same time.
I think it's
going
to be awkward in the most entertaining way.
Yeah.
So,
or painful.
Yo, check out this game, Party at Tiffany Burrell's House at partyrpg.com. I don't know how you got that domain, Chris.
I know.
But like, good on you.
Yeah.
Yeah, good on you. Can't believe you got that domain. But yeah, partyrpg.com. Check it out. Okay, so this was an awesome interview that you're going to be listening to. One with Jian Shim. It was really good. It was deep. It was like, I think the way we ended it was, this was part one of a to be determined number of future episodes. Yeah, it was dope.
Yeah, lots of things we covered.
Yeah, we covered, you know, the importance of outdoor skills, the feeling that we all have that sometimes we're not meant to be connected with nature, but that connection really mm-hmm. does exist.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about you know, culture clash
mm-hmm.
with
the Asian diaspora in
general. Asian diaspora.
How that manifests.
Yeah, it was both like heavy and light at the same time this episode. And it went on for well over an hour.
Mm.
So we won't go long with this. So just enjoy this conversation that we had with the amazing and very skillful in terms of, you'll find out, Jian has all these really incredible skills. That Jian is a real life like D&D character.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Real life ranger slash druid.
She is who you dream to be.
yeah. I know. My people. but enjoy this conversation. And give it up for Jian Shim. Yeah, I'm here now. Fuck, that is a giant bummer.
What a great conversation it was. I mean, it's going to continue to be, but that's okay.
No,
for what
no,
it's worth, I don't have anything scheduled until 8 o'clock my time. So, like, if we if you want to, like, not necessarily.
No, let's just run it back. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Let's
okay.
Do it.
Cool.
You know what?
Cool.
So for the audience members, you know, you've heard Jade and I already talk, and now we're getting into this amazing conversation with Gian. And so we lost the first 38 minutes of the audio because of a technical fuck up on my part, and I totally own up to that because I think it's important to own up to your mistakes. That audio, that bonus audio, will actually be an exclusive for patrons of the One Shot Network. So if you head to patreon.com/oneshotpodcast, you can hear a 38 minute bonus conversation that we had. You know, we talked about my intense dislike of being called Dan. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We talked about, you know, Asians in media, and we talked about
etiquette and rituals.
And I think that in of itself is, you know, worth an entire episode.
Yeah. Etiquette and rituals.
Yeah.
If you want the pro tip life hack summary of that etiquette and rituals thing, just leave your shoes outside of any Asian friend's house. Just leave them the fuck outside.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the first. So if you aren't a patron, I mean, you should be a patron, but if you aren't, that's the spark note for the bonus episode. It's leave your shoes outside. Take them the fuck off. Don't spend your money on, you know, a fancy Rube Goldberg shoe cleaner so you can wear your shoes indoors. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, no monsters are going to come through. We were talking about Pacific Rim. You aren't going to need to get your shoes on and run out of your house. And if you do and there are monsters, you'd probably already be dead.
Yep.
So
you're already in trouble for other reasons.
You're already in trouble.
So take off your shoes.
Yeah, so take off your shoes.
Yeah.
But before... Funny. Yeah, I know. God damn it. But you know what? That actually, I think, you know, that extra content is more suited as a bonus content, I think, because it's about our dynamic, the three of us, you know, you, Jade, myself. Before we got cut off, I was talking about, you know, learning traditional skills and me wanting to be, you know, a real life D&D character.
Yeah.
And so I was saying, you know, like I'm really into archery. And I've been shooting bows for as long as I've been playing RPGs.
So cool.
Right. And I got into, you know, learning traditional skills because of RPGs. So like I wanted to be that D&D character. And I had this amazing, you know, educator who also was the guy who inspired me to actually go and study archaeology.
Mm, mentors are so important.
Wow.
And it's so weird. Really, like, because like we met, his name is Dr. Robert Mason. Mm-hmm. He's on Twitter, but he's a database technician at the Royal Ontario Museum. Hmm. And I met him when I was 10, and I started coming to the D&D program at the ROM that I now teach.
Mm.
And I met him there, and he would teach the students how to shoot. And
cool.
Yeah, and so it was like...
So relevant.
Yeah, and so I started to come back to the program, and then now I teach it. And
kids how to shoot.
And I teach the kids how to shoot now. But I still bring them to meet him and see artifacts. But you know, so I've been shooting English longbows and other historical bows since then. And I recently took up, you know, compound bow shooting.
Oh, cool. I actually don't use compound bows. I use almost exclusively recurve just because we do a lot. We teach bow making bow making is
really
satisfying. It's actually one of my fitness goals, to build up my upper body enough that like bow making doesn't take me as long as it takes me right now. Because a lot of the process is literally just like drawing wood off of the stave that you're carving down in order to make the bow.
Does it engage specifically?
It's like your back and your arms. When I made my first bow, it's like I just remember feeling like I'd done 100 push-ups every hour for like 2 days straight. Just like it just hurts so much. And that was with a forgiving material. That was with rattan. I haven't finished any hardwood bows yet, but my friends at work who make them regularly, like they're built people.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine what hardwood would be like if that was rattan. Yeah.
Well, there was a shipwreck called the Mary Rose. It's a Tudor shipwreck, and they found, I want to say, hundreds of English longbows on it, but they also found dead archers on it. And their skeletal structure was asymmetrical from shooting those bows.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow, like those, that's cool.
If you, if you ever read about the English longbow, it is an incredible weapon. Arguably one of the most effective artillery weapons.
Mm. Yes.
I don't say precision. Yes. I say artillery weapons because they used it to volley.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
But that go ahead.
I read, and this is apocryphal. I haven't followed it up with any academic sources, but I read that the reason why in Britain you hold up two fingers, like facing out, like a peace sign, but flipped is like a fuck you.
Yeah, it
it dates back to like longbow archers.
The Hundred Years' War.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So like people would like capture British archers and then cut off their fingers before they executed them. And so
fuck you.
Yeah, yeah, basically. And then when battle started, like all the archers would, you know, quote unquote, flip off the other side to be like, we're fucking here and we're going to fuck you up. Right. And now it's like turned into this kind of very defiant, crass gesture.
Right.
Which is so cool.
100%.
That's so cool that that's real. Oh, I love it. I'm so glad.
Yeah. So I learned how to shoot bows. And then when I was 16, I studied at the, it's in Toronto, Jade, we should go. Mm-hmm. It's at the Academy of European Medieval Martial Arts. And I learned.
Where is that?
It's near Ossington and DuPont.
Ah, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's
okay.
At the Fighting Arts Collective.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I studied there when I was 16 and I learned longsword fighting.
Cool.
Well, I guess we would call it an arming sword. A longsword is like, in D&D, it's the bastard sword. Mm. So I learned sword fighting. And then in university, I learned lock picking.
Cool. Yep.
We teach lockpicking with truckers, actually.
Yeah,
we teach it as part of our secret agents camp curriculum.
Oh, cool.
What else do you teach?
It's like really basic lock. It's like not the Yale lock, but you know, padlocks. And we teach the beginning of like how to like sort of tell how to pick a like a locker combination lock.
Nice.
It's a really great fidget, actually, for children.
I bet.
But it's also, you know, a lot of our curriculum is sort of built around this question of like, if infrastructure breaks down, what skills do you need? And like being able to pick locks is actually a very useful skill.
Yeah.
It has come in handy multiple times for
me. Oh my God. So many times.
Yeah. So many times. Like I think that the hardest lock that I've picked, I've picked a master, one of those master class, that brand, reinforced padlocks. Mm. I picked one of those.
Nice.
I have a five-piece titanium set. It's been the same set that I've had since my university days. And so like when I was looking you up and I was doing all of my research on you, which still sounds weird even though I've already said it once. I was like, trackers, that's so cool. And you know, that's something that I would have loved going to when I was a kid, because I had to kind of learn all of this stuff on my own as an adult.
Mm.
And I didn't get that growing up. My parents like never took me camping. I had to do that on my own.
Sure.
My parents really aren't into hiking. They're not into, you know, just being outdoors. Like I'm so lucky that the direction that my life has gone in has allowed me to do that. Like I got paid to go to do outdoor survival training.
That's awesome.
I love that.
That's
yeah.
great.
Right. That's cool.
And then that is when I knew that I don't like the cold.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like all the archaeologists at the university I was at, you know, we had the opportunity to go do survival training and most people didn't really need it. It was mostly offered to the Arctic archaeologists.
Mm. Okay.
You have to carry rifles on site because of polar bears and all that.
Right. Right.
And I was
like,
it was an option. Mm. And I was like, you know what? I want to tag along.
Yeah.
I want to do this. And it was just like all the Arctic archaeologists who like can handle the cold and me. Also the only person of color. And,
oh, wow. Yeah.
And our instructor was, I shit you not, an ex-British like army sniper.
Mm.
Holy
and
crap.
It was so intense. And he was like, he did so many things that you normally wouldn't do. Like one of our scenarios was like, you walk in the woods and you find somebody who has an arrow in them.
Oh,
and like, I remember another thing so vividly because it was like, my instincts were like, because I remember when that happened and I knew we were being graded, I pulled out my knife and I was like, okay, where is this person? We got to watch out. Yeah. I got so into it. And yeah. There was another
it's
day
LARPing.
When.
You're LARPing.
I was LARPing. And this is perfect because you're the perfect person to talk to about this.
Wait, was that the right answer for him?
Well, he was like, you're the only person to ever think that there might be somebody hostile in the woods.
I think that was the right answer.
And I think that's the right answer. I don't think that was the answer he was looking for, right. But it's still the right answer.
Right. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I'm so proud of you.
You know, I saw a shimmering in the wood, and then three laser dots came out of nowhere, and we fought this alien. I covered myself in mud. I was shirtless, and then I dodged a nuke. You know?
Oh, man. You guys can't see it right now, but I had to rush in from work such that I didn't have time to shower, and we did a natural camo lesson with my
I'll just take a selfie.
Can you take a selfie?
I'll take a selfie and send it to you guys. But I'm literally recording this with like a bunch of just charcoal and mud.
That's
like
amazing.
See, this is why this episode needed to happen. This is why this needed to happen.
I'm so gratified to hear, like, just through like our own different sets of circumstances on like opposite coasts in two different countries, like we've developed these interests in Jade. I don't know how much like outdoor stuff you do, but like it seems like there's a lot of passion for like land connection between the three of us. And that's really, really exciting for me because I think that like growing up, because I was sort of like you, Daniel, right? Like my parents weren't super into hiking. We never went car camping. I think my first time camping actually was like camping was my staff training for this job at Trackers.
Oh, no way. That's cool.
Yeah. No, I remember at the staff training, some people were complaining about some of the like showers, like not running hot and stuff like that. And I was just like, yeah, like it, you know, just trying to keep morale up and being like, it's not so bad, right? It's sort of like jumping into like a creek or something. And they're like, I mean, like, you know, you sound like you have a lot of experience. So I'm like, nope, this is literally my first time camping. And they're like, oh, fuck, I should stop complaining. It was very sweet. But it like I wasn't expecting to like it so much. I got hired at the job because at the time, the person who was the artisans department coordinator, who's the job I eventually took over, just needed like a bunch more staff for summer camp. Summer camp is our bread and butter. Our staff swells from like our core staff of like 20 people to like 100 because of the volume of summer campers we get. And so I was hired basically because they knew I was a giant nerd and really liked tabletop RPGs.
Yo, I wish I got hired because of that for a job.
It's like a very, it's a very weird job title because it's survival skills. You know, there's like lots of alliterative ways I can put it. I can say survival skills through storytelling or land skills through LARPing. But at the end of the day, it is a combination of being outside and connecting with nature and role playing. Is very weird. It's a hard job to explain.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah. Have you ever seen Darkon, the documentary?
Darkon? No, I haven't.
Yo, it's Darkon. It's a documentary about boffer LARPs. Yeah. And so I saw this like 6 years ago, this documentary. And it's about one particular LARP. And it's like this continuous LARP that's going on over somewhere in Washington or something. But their fantasy map overlays the metropolitan map of the region. Mm. The documentary follows like this one kingdom, but it's really like five people and how they're trying to seize power in this fantasy world. But one of the things that like really like struck me by watching this documentary is that when you're participating in one of these LARPs, you're being active. And you are being outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Boffer LARPing. I've never played a Boffer LARP.
I've always wanted to.
Yeah.
Me too. There aren't a whole lot in the Bay Area or California as a whole. There just aren't a lot of them. I get the feeling the East Coast has a lot more.
Yeah. I just want to wear the costumes. I don't even have to do it. Yeah. I just want to go hiking and wear the costume.
Well, I really just
want the cloak.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah, I actually, my boss asked me, she was like, you know, like we have enough that like every department gets to ask for sort of like one thing to like prep for the summer season. What would you like? And a lot, you know, like my friend Levi, who runs archery, he was like, I would love like all of these like materials for bow making and stuff. and whatever. And I was like, you know what I would love? I would love to dry clean all our cloaks.
Yeah.
So not once in the like 4+ years that I've been here have we gotten them dry cleaned. And like, right. I don't want to wear them anymore.
They're all like crusty.
A lot of them look like Gandalf's cloak from Lord of the Rings. Right?
Oh, they're don't just, dry clean. Those are great.
I know. They might also have like poison oak on them.
Yeah.
So. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
They just look like tolerance maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm so fascinated by your work because, like, I don't think I've ever met anybody who has a job like you do, but also is, you know, so connected to gaming and is so passionate about using games to get people to connect with the world, you know, outside.
Oh, thank
and,
you.
And, you know, connect with themselves. Like, so I read Pin Feathers and Cloud Studies. And,
I'm so glad.
And I was actually thinking about it. Like I listened to the music that went with it, like not my kind of music, but I listened to the music that went with it. And like, I did the whole thing.
Oh, wow. And that's awesome.
Yeah. And it like, it gave me the feels.
Yeah.
Like, and I, you know what? I get the feels a lot. Like, and I'm really open about it. Like I bawled at like my girlfriend just sitting over there. Like I cried at Crazy Rich Asians.
I still haven't seen it. No spoilers, like
I cried at the end.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Like, I expect I will cry as well.
Like I cried at the end, and like you know, like I cried at Up. Obviously, another great Asian character.
Oh, I know. I love him. He's so
like wants to earn his patches and I'm just like, oh, like I always wanted to do scouts and I never got to when I was a kid.
Oh yeah.
Cause again, my parents weren't into that.
Right. Sure.
But like, I read through your LARP and I was like, man, if I was a bird, that's really what I gravitated towards. Cause I was like, what kind of bird would I be? And I was like, I'd be a motherfucking secretary bird.
Oh my God. That's amazing. So I work with a lot of just incredible, incredible naturalists. And some of them are really good at bird calls. And out of this developed one of my personal favorite bus games. It's a trivia game. It's called Bird Up. And basically Bird Up. And it's a way of getting the instructors to sort of like get out of the daze that you sometimes get into at like 9 o'clock in the morning on a school bus. Yep. Mm-hmm. And you just go down the road and you're like, you ask them straight up, like, what kind of bird are you today? And all these apples and be like, I think, you know, today I think I feel like a crow, right? Because it like, this was me actually. I was like, I'm so tired. I don't know what to say. I'm a crow. And then the person running Bird Up would be like, oh, cool. What sound does a crow make? And then you have to try to make the sound. And this game is especially good when the person running it is good at bird calls. Because then they can be like, oh, great. I think it sounds like this. And then they'll just do the call. And it's a really great way of engaging the kids because they're like, oh, I didn't know that bird sounded like that.
Are you good at bird calls?
What's
your best one?
My best one is the crow call because we use it as a summoning call for micro school. It's like an unobtrusive, non-human
this
call.
This is amazing. That's so I didn't know this was a thing.
See, when you said summoning call, I was like, what RPG are you playing?
It's the one bird call I can do like pretty reliably. Decently.
Yo, let's hear it. Let's hear it. Really I know people are going to be like,
yeah, it might be really loud. I'm going to call them. I'm going to hold the mic a little bit from my face.
Yeah.
So imagine I'm curious. Camo face page. Sure. And doing this call.
This is like embarrassingly on brand. Hang on. Okay.
Yo, that's good.
It's so good.
That's so good.
I have a bit of a scratchy throat, so it's like actually a little rusty, but it's because I was doing it all day today. The kids had a lot of energy today. We were going to do like all these focused activities and stuff, and they were like running. I was like, it's camo day. We're doing camo today.
Right.
Yo, that's super cool. Like, I wish I was kidding. Just like, you know what day it is? It's camo day.
Fit it into your life.
I just fit it into my life. I'm just going to... Sarah is going to be like, why are you wearing camo? It's just camo day, Sarah. It's camo day.
Yeah. I love this curriculum so much. I love this job. This is the first time I've like really loved my job, like for real. And one of the things I really love about it is like the ability to like loop it into my creative work. Because like now, you know, I talk about this a lot with friends of mine who are also designers. And I have a lot of like really incredible friends who are brilliant at the work that they do. And we talk sometimes about through lines, like the things that sort of drive us in our work. And for me, a lot of it is, like, lately I'm actually reconciling. So for me, my through line really is, like, I just want to connect as many people as possible, like, really deeply with the natural world. All of the LARPs that I write, not all of them, like, I have some designs that are specifically meant to be played at, like, gaming conventions, which have a certain barrier to entry, right? And it's not just cost, it's also cultural. Right. Especially if you are, for example, non-white, but also if you're not of certain socioeconomic classes, if you just aren't into nerd shit and all of that stuff ties together. Right. You know, a convention is not going to be for you necessarily. So I'm trying to build up a portfolio of work that is, like, really accessible in cost and language. I try to use very plain, like, not academic language, for 1 to 2 player LARPs. Because when I first was introduced to the idea of a one player LARP, I was like, what is that? You know, it sounds so odd. But, like, when I started playing them and reading them, I was really, like, enchanted by their accessibility and also the resonance of experience that you can have with them. And you could play these games and literally tell nobody about them, but they'll still affect you and they'll still change you and they'll have an impact on the way that you experience the world. And so I want to write as many games as I can that foster that and are in that spirit of accessibility and all have, like, a core or a kernel of just, like looking outside or being outside. So, like, Pin Feathers and Cloud Studies, those two games, I was that was my first run at writing, like, this kind of LARP. And I was really, I was really gratified that people liked it as much as they did. It also got put on the, the science
Nebula?
Fiction.
Nebula.
It's so it's like, congrats. This thing. It's like, thank you. It's eligible for a Nebula nomination now. So, like, people who have memberships the science fiction writers of America, I think, could nominate.
Science fiction writer. SFWA
membership. I'll throw up a link at the end.
It's pinned on your Twitter profile.
Because someone who has a friend of mine who's won, like, Nebulas and Hugos was like, you should make this really visible. And I was like, I guess is the easiest way to do that.
Signal boost the crap out of that.
Yeah. So I played Pin Feathers and Cloud Studies earlier. Daniel sent it to me while I was commuting. I was starting my commute, and so I actually played it when I stepped onto the subway, and I was, like, horribly uncomfortable in the subway, and I was like, okay, this is in the instructions.
It's perfect.
Yeah.
And I had such a melancholy it was such a melancholy gameplay experience. I was surprised at how much I was able to get into it because it was a subway filled with, like, so many people. I was so sweaty. I hate the subway during the winter. It was awful. It was like rush hour. Yeah. Nothing was good. But everything that you're saying, it really accomplished that for me. I was just outside of my body for a while.
Yeah.
And I know I said it was melancholy, but, you know, you don't always play games just for fun or happy feels. It was really nice.
I mean, that's one of the things about the LARP scene that I've discovered in the last year or two is a lot of people play for, like, deep emotional resonance. And that is a very different kind of game than I think people think they're going to play. But when I look back on my own role-playing, like, history, like, how I got into it, the first system I ever really played in earnest was Apocalypse World, and then very shortly after that, Monster Hearts, which are like the same engine, but, like, there is now a reason why it's really difficult actually for me to, like, sit down and play D&D because and so I'm really used to just, like, sitting down and then immediately you just fucking go all in, right? Just all in. And I, and then, like, through designing LARPs and through designing all these things, like, I was accustomed to creating those same high octane experiences, you know, that are child appropriate. Now, at work, we're getting, like, more interested in maybe doing events for adults, like land scale oriented LARPs for adults that aren't necessarily cool. huge budget weekend LARPs, but could take place over like a single overnight or something like that. Mm-hmm. Especially because
totally important for adults as well.
Absolutely. Especially like, I think in urban settings and suburban settings, people like, this is a thing that happens. I talked about this with my interview in my interview with Alex Roberts for her Backstory podcast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was on that show too.
Yeah. She's such a great interviewer. And this we talked a lot about like how people lose and become alienated in nature, how people lose that connection, because I actually think that literally every single person, urban or rural or no, like when they are kids, especially, they have that intrinsic connection and love for the land. You can't help it. Like, you are a person in the world and you are a part of the land. One of the things I say in my acknowledgments in Pin Feathers and Cloud Studies is like, one of my major inspirations was this thing called the Cloud Appreciation Society.
Yeah, I read that.
Which is just, it's literally, it's a membership club for people who love clouds. Literally, they just love clouds. And one of the things that the founder says that I think is really beautiful is that we don't live beneath the sky, we live within it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was talking about it with my friend Idan, and he was saying, because he was the one who introduced me to it, his brother is a member. And he was like, yeah, you know, when I was talking to my brother, one of the things he said that resonated with me is that you can live in like a landlocked gray, like urban grid, but you're always going to be able to see beautiful clouds. It's like actually so the true. It's the most accessible way to connect to nature and to that like profound. Yeah, exactly. To look up. And that I was just like, and then someone bought me a membership anonymously like the next day.
Oh,
and
I
was
amazing.
Like, yeah. I love it was that. So beautiful. it was like a perfect gift. And like it's moments like that that I think as adults we forget that alienation and can connect again. But there's this narrative, right? We tell ourselves like, oh, I'm not outdoorsy. Like, oh, I don't like hiking. Oh, I've never been camping. I'd be bad at being outside. And I think the more people tell themselves those stories, the further and further away from that connection to nature that they feel, even though it's not true, right? Mm-hmm. And you see that with people who work like office jobs, who play boffer LARPs, who will tell you to your face like, oh yeah, no, like I'm not outdoorsy. I don't go camping. When they spend like a weekend every month going camping.
Right.
Yep,
right.
Yep.
Yeah. And like going camping in costume, right? Like in character, which is like
even
so much
more difficult.
Yeah.
It's interesting because it's a different engagement. And at the same time, when they're out there on the land, how much are they actually engaging with the land? How much is the space a participant in their experience versus a backdrop? And I talked about this recently with a bunch of friends. Like for me, when I design anything, I think that having the space be an active part of the experience, almost like another player, is really, really crucial to forming that connection.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been talking about this a lot at work in my work context. Like, how do we create that sense of what we call the non-human community? Like, how does that actually, how do we teach that in a way where kids really feel like that's true, where they look at like a 100-year-old redwood tree and think like, oh, that's my friend. And
have you ever heard of bio blitzes?
No. Oh yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. Is that when you like take a field guide out and you just try to identify as many things as possible?
Yeah. So with my last job, I was like tangentially involved with the bio blitz, and I've participated in them and wrote for Canada Wildlife, and I shot a video on the Canada 150 bioblitz in Toronto.
No big deal.
No. I did it for fun. my friend Stacey Lee Kerr is one of the coordinator of the Ontario bioblitz, and she's actually trying to get into designing board games around the concept of a bioblitz.
Is this an annual thing?
Yeah, it is.
That's so cool.
So what's cool about the Ontario BioBlitz is that it's done in collaboration with obviously scientists. So they set up like a home base research station where people can bring photos. There's actually an app. Do you know about iNaturalist?
I do. Yeah. They've improved so much over the years. It was almost unusable when they first started, and now like we use it pretty frequently.
Yeah, you need to populate it with users
exactly,
and content.
Exactly. Yeah.
iNaturalist, for those who are listening, is an app where you can literally snap a photo of something, and the community will help identify it in nature. And it is
super
a
handy.
Really cool way of, you know, connecting our reliance on technology with the practice of going outside.
Mm. Yeah,
it's a really cool app. It's free.
Yeah.
Like go get that app. It's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many apps in China that I got exposed to that we don't have here.
Oh, that's such a bummer. Oh,
it's a huge bummer. So, September 2017 was the last time I was in China. I was working in a small city called Yongkang, on an excavation. And, I was like, I was down really deep. It was like 40 degrees, no wind, no shade. And I was the only one doing the labor. And my supervisor is a botanist.
Oh, wow.
And so, because I studied, so what I did for my graduate studies was I studied, you know, ancient ceramics and, mm-hmm. You know, essentially the invention of agriculture. Mm-hmm. So I'm really into like traditional, you know, skills. And there, my Chinese colleagues had this app where you can literally scan a plant with your phone and the app will identify it for you.
That's awesome. That's so
we
cool.
don't have that. That sucks.
No, well, there are, cool. And it's free in China. And there are certain ones that you can get here that you have to pay for, but they're not as good.
Right.
Like we did like a side by side to see if the English ones were as good, and they were not.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, the thing about iNaturalist that works really well is it taps into the way that people engage with smartphone technology already.
Yes.
There's another app that I use fairly often. I generally try to rely on field guides. I try not to rely on my phone very much because like batteries run out.
That's true. 100%.
Yeah. But also like sometimes kids are so tech literate, it doesn't hurt to have multiple resources, right?
Yeah.
And so one app that I recommend for the kids who are really avid about birds is there's like the field guide that we go to like reliably as the foundation is the Sibley Bird Guide. There's like a whole series of Sibley Bird Guides. They're so good. But there's also an app put out by Cornell, the Cornell Department of Ornithology, which is very, very good.
Sweet.
It's called the Merlin Bird App. And you look, when you see a bird and you're just like, what is that fucking bird? I want to know. They
first that exact language.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much. You're just like, what a cool bird. What the hell is it? And you open the app and then it says, what size is the bird? And there's like sparrow, robin, crow, duck, and like goes up. And then you choose like roughly like what size it seems. And then it's like, what three colors are dominant on it? And then it's like, where are you? And you enter your zip code and then it sort of narrows it
down.
This
is cool. Yeah.
I've just downloaded the app. It's Merlin Bird ID by Cornell Lab.
Yeah.
On
the
Apple App Store.
Mm-hmm. It's also free.
Really cool.
Yeah. It's also free. And it's like, it takes up not too much space and it's fast. So I've used that in the field multiple times and it's pretty good. And one of the things that it does that I like also is it aggregates photos. So one of the disadvantages of certain field guides, Sibley is pretty good about this, but some only have like one or two photos or images. And some species of birds, particularly like raptors, have multiple morphs. Like they have a lot of variation in their appearance and their feather pattern and color. Sometimes they even have like a lot of variation in size. And so IDing them can be sort of tricky.
And seasonality too is one thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's also a bunch of field guides that you can actually get on Kindle. So I have a couple Hawks at a Distance or Hawks in Flight ID guides that are really great because generally speaking, if you see a hawk or a falcon or any other bird of prey, it's either going to be perched on something or like in the air. And when it's in the air, you're relying, depending on the distance, relying on a lot of silhouette scanning. And depending on the lighting, you're either going to see a lot of the morph or not. But like,
I'm learning so much. This is so sweet.
Yo, so, like basically like my two worlds are like science communication and gaming, and I'm just realizing that that's yours too.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
And like for me, you know, when you were saying earlier that like being autodidactic was something that you sort of not lament, but are just like, oh, I really wish I had like elders or mentors in this. I'm completely autodidactic in this too. I've mostly had like peer mentorship and peer education and all of this through also work. Yeah. And like we talk about this also a lot, like at work, of how a lot of the skills that we teach, we must attribute, like we have an obligation to attribute both as like the ones that are universal as universal skills. Like, for example, fire making is something that was taught in literally every single human culture at some point in their human history. And that
everybody
is like,
should learn how to do that.
Yeah. Everyone should learn how to do it. It's like the birthright of literally every single person on this planet. And also there are some skills that are very specifically indigenous to certain regions, right? So a lot of different, I'm Korean, there's like a real tradition, a really rich tradition of archery and bow making and arrow making in Korea, right? Like there's South Korea has this really cool government program where people are declared national treasures if they practice traditional skills and arts very, very, very well, if they're like the best in their field. And
that's
so
really cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
And so there's like two people, I don't know their names offhand, but I've seen videos of them both at work. One is a bowyer and one is like an arrow maker, and they're both national treasures.
That's cool.
Yeah, because they make them in the Korean design, which is very different from the style of bow making that we teach. And so when we say like, you know, like this is how bows are made, we do our best to be very specific. There's an incredible museum in the Bay Area, the Oakland Museum of California, that has a participatory collection of Ohlone, Miwok, Pomo, and some Chumash artifacts that the museum curators are in active conversation and dialogue with members of those communities so that everything there is there by permission.
That's
so
fantastic.
Yeah. So I love taking my kids there. And the Ohlone bows that we see there are really, really interesting. So you were talking earlier about using English longbows, Daniel, like for, and like how you're interested in bow hunting. These bows are real short. That was the first thing that occurred to me when I saw them. I'm like, they're so wee, like they're really, really small. And I imagine the poundage on them, like the draw weight is really high. Yeah. And then when I think about, you know, my time spent out on the land in the bay and the biomes that people would be hunting in and the kind of game you would be hunting, like deer and rabbit and all of these things, that makes everything clicks into place. I'm like, oh, that makes sense, because you're going to be stooping in all of the chaparral. You're going to be moving through a bunch of underbrush. If you have like a big ass bow, you're going to get caught up in things. Not to mention it really stands out like it's an eyesore. Which
that's
is very
the difference between the Japanese longbow and the English longbow. Like the Japanese longbow is one that is used from horseback, and the English one you can't use from horseback.
Yeah, no, good luck. Yeah,
because of where you grip the bow.
Exactly. Yeah, and a lot of Korean archery is also done from horseback, and we have several styles of bow that we teach from that are bought at work, including those big ass like Samick Sage recurve bows, you know, the ones with those huge honking grip with like an arrow rest and riser. But we also have like these very sleek quote unquote horse bows that are designed off of like Korean archery equipment that is in turn designed to be shot from the back of a horse. So it's light and it's ambidextrous, and they're just a very different look, very different design.
I have a diamond edge. That's the bow. I really want a Hoyt, but they're super expensive.
They are expensive.
Is that the compound bow you have?
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
The Hoyt bows are over $1,000 US.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And bows for reference for people listening, a lot of sort of entry level to mid level bows cost anywhere from like $150 to $400. So if you're looking at a grand, like that's quite an investment.
Yeah, and you have to pay for like arrows ain't cheap.
Oh, yeah.
Arrows
are not
expensive.
Cheap.
It's like you lose an arrow, that's like throwing $10 at least. That's like throwing $10 to the wind.
Per shaft, right? Like per arrow.
Per shaft, yeah.
Yeah.
And then you have to pay for your release as well. I've seen releases go for like $200.
Oh, yeah. The arrows are the expansion cards in Magic the Gathering, right? You get the deck for free. The bow is like, the bow is somewhat accessible, right? So you get that first deck for free, but then anytime you want to build it up, like if you actually want to do anything, you have to like pay out the nose to do it.
Yeah. And you have to, you can like bows, like modern, like compound bows are like fully customizable. So you can get new grips for it.
Oh my God.
Like you can get like new scopes. Like I only have a 3-pin scope. Maybe I want to get a 5-pin scope. so I can dial into 5 different ranges instead of like 3.
And like if you're bow hunting, realistically, you're using a compound bow. It is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like.
I met a guy who hunted with black powder weapons.
Whoa.
Yeah. So I have a gun license.
Oh, that's awesome. I've actually never shot a gun before. And like this year, I really want to get a range membership and like start practicing because I want to go hunting pretty soon.
Yeah, it's something that like I do with my family, with my dad.
Oh wow, that's awesome.
but I've had a gun license since I was 18.
Wow,
that's awesome.
And it's and I realize that like the listeners probably like, whoa, what, like if this is not a Canadian thing. Like a Canadian having a gun license,
it's really not. Yeah,
it's really uncommon. I only know 4 people in my friend circle. No, 4 people in my like outward friend circle, and like maybe 2 people in my inner friend circle who have firearms licenses.
I can think of like one outside of you.
Yeah, and like I got mine as a part of school.
Yeah. I know a lot. I mean, surprise, in the United States, right? And
yeah.
Right.
Even in California, which has a reputation for having like much higher standards of regulation than a lot of states, I know a lot of local friends who have firearms licenses and own firearms. But the thing is, like, most of them are white, actually.
Yeah,
and
I know one Asian who has a gun license.
Yeah, and when you look at the history of like gun control law or open carry law in the states, like that wasn't always true. Like I learned actually only a couple years ago that the reason why that open carry was banned in California was because it coincided with the Black Panthers arming themselves.
Oh.
And for a really long time, you know, other people wanted to ban open carry, but for like quote unquote fringe reasons. And then suddenly that legislation was unearthed and pushed through really fast.
Right.
There
are also those iconic images and videos we were talking about the LA riots. Those Korean shop owners, you know, arming up and getting ready for looters.
Yeah. And people, it's crazy to me that the LA riots happened within our living history. And so few people know what they are, let alone why it happened and what transpired. And multiple times I've like fielded a lot of like really shocked reactions of like, why do all these Korean store owners, how do they even know how to fire a gun? Right?
Yeah, you don't associate that with with any of it. Yeah.
Well, especially in like the urban areas we live in, I think that people forget that East Asian immigrant communities are at their roots in America, especially working class. They are working class communities. The model minority thing only happened in the late 80s.
Well, yeah. I mean, the model minority thing was also incredibly damaging.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a deliberate, like, choreography to drive a wedge between intra people of color organization. Because, like, up until that point, like, for example, again, looking at local California history and local Bay Area history, the Black Panthers worked with the Third World Movement, all the Pan-Asian movements. There was a lot of solidarity. And that doesn't mean that everything was perfect across the board, but there was an acknowledgement of like, we are working with you to support your causes. And again, that sort of reciprocity of labor, that reciprocity of work and visibility that we were talking about in a very different context before. And then the model minority myth started, and it started eroding so quickly.
There was that really Time magazine cover.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're aware of
it. Yeah. There was
this cover of Time magazine about the model minority, and it was these Asian kids on the cover, and they like staged it so that they looked like the stereotypical smart Asian kid.
What year was this?
Oh, this has got to be in the...
It was in the 80s, I think, right?
80s?
Yeah. Either the early or mid 80s.
And it was... It really set perceptions of Asians back, especially considering that, you know, there was like the Exclusion Act.
Yeah.
And considering that, you know, there were the LA riots, with which, you know, after that really damaged people's perceptions of Koreans.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Because they dared to fight back.
Right. Right. There was this idea of like Asians as the docile demographic, right? Yep. Especially light-skinned East Asians. The less brown you were, the closer you are to assimilating into visual white values, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I was growing up, like that buying into white supremacy was this funny thing where on the one hand, I don't know how like your parents talk to you about it, but my parents, my family, and like a lot of the other Asian American kids I know who are East Asian specifically, especially, would hear from their parents all the time, like one of the reasons why you want to be a doctor or a lawyer or, you know, go into business at a certain level is so that you will make as much as white people, right? Or you're still going to have to work like twice as hard and you'll get half as much, but you will be seen respectfully in white communities, right? Like this is how you will survive. And at the same time, there was so much frustration with whiteness. There was both a recognition of like white supremacist values that was both upheld in a lot of the language and the professions and just all of these like sort of intrinsic implicit values that I was receiving as like a second gen Asian American kid. And at the same time, you know, like I would come home and like, you know, just one time I made the mistake of like talking back to my mom in a way that I'd overheard a friend of mine who was like very white talk back to her mom. Oh yeah, we all oh no is right. This she is just
if I talk back to my parents like my white friends talk back to their parents, I will get my ass beat.
Dude, like she looked like she didn't even have to say it. She just looked at me and I knew immediately like, oh, I fucked up. And straight up, she goes, is this how your white friends talk to their parents? Because I know you did not hear this from another Korean kid. And I was like, oh, you're right. Oh, God.
See, I wouldn't even get that. My dad would be like, get the feather duster. The bamboo feather duster. Shit, that hurt.
Oh, man.
Shit, that hurt.
Yo, like.
No, don't do that to your kids now. Don't do that to your kids.
Yeah,
now.
Corporal punishment is very damaging to child development.
Very damaging. Very.
And
very
I remember very clearly my dad's stories that he told like for laughs, right? Of like being in the public school system in Korea. Because this is something, it always like shocks and appalls my white friends. And I'm like, sure, it's not great. And people definitely have like cracked down on it a lot. But also like it is a different country with a different culture. Mm-hmm. So like, just slow your roll a little bit.
That's like with the Marie Kondo thing. People are just judging her because they don't have an understanding of Japanese values.
Yeah. And there is something like it's different levels, right? Like corporal punishment. Still not
certainly, of course. Definitely.
And also the ways in which well-meaning white people and well-meaning liberal white people, especially, I think, condemn things that we can all universally acknowledge are not great, but suddenly there's an escalation of language, there's an escalation of vehemence behind it that I find like really suspect, to be honest.
I agree.
Yeah. No, but my dad has stories about stuff that like now people do in like CrossFit training. They like pay good money to do the shit that his teachers punished him with, which is like hilarious to me. Like at one point he told me a story about how, you know, he didn't talk back, but he was like talking while the teacher was talking. And a common thing was he would make this teacher would make him hold a chair above his head for like 20 minutes.
Whoa.
Oh, that's CrossFit.
You're just holding a plate above your head.
Yeah. And he said that there was a spot in the room. He found it like the third time it happened. There was a spot in the room where there was just like a little nail hanging out of the wall, just a little bit.
That
had been painted over. And so he would just act really anguished.
Good
and
for him.
And now I think about that story. I'm like, oh, he was LARPing.
Yeah, no, 100%. 100%. What I like most about your LARP and your LARPs and like your work in general is just that it's unique. And to me, it's different. Like I was, you know, introduced to the world of LARP at Metatopia. And like I still talk about it. Like I played a LARP and I participated in like as a designer on the alpha test of another about K-pop. Because I fucking love K-pop.
Amazing.
I think I know which game you're talking about. Yeah. Was it Last Train to Busan?
No, but okay. We interviewed Cleo, yeah, the author, yeah, yeah, in the last episode. Hmm. No, it was a new one. Somebody, oh, okay. It was a white person was making writing a K-pop LARP.
Oh, interesting.
And I was the only Asian person in the room.
Was that telling that tone? My
bad. Oh yeah, no, that was my, I mean, that was my,
this is also my reaction.
That was my, like, my friend, my business partner, he was like, yo, Daniel, I'm sitting in the alpha test for what I didn't know what was a K-pop LARP. He's like, and he was like, know. He's like, Daniel, there's only white people here. Like, oh, you need no. to be here. And like, all this goes wrong.
Save me.
And I was like, I'm on my way.
How did you know?
Yikes.
It went okay. It went okay. I think that I told that person to read Cleo's game.
Yeah.
And then I told that person to listen to a whole bunch of other K-pop because they were basically basing it only on their understanding of BTS.
Yeah.
And I was like, you got to really look at the industry. Mm-hmm. They're not, I mean, they're like the biggest band
yeah.
right now.
In yeah.
the world. But yeah. like, they are not representative of the entire right. thing. Cause me, I always go by like, yo, check out my boy Jay Park. Cause he's my favorite.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Totally.
But you need a bigger perspective.
But yeah, you need a bigger perspective. And it was interesting, but you know, I'm really glad that we had you on for this. Because we were originally going to do this as a live stream, but I think it turned into something much bigger,
yeah.
and something that you know should be an episode of on its own. Mm-hmm. Like you know, totally. We talked about you know
several episodes
because we need to do more. We need to do more.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I'm so down. I'm so down.
I think just like talking to you about you know connecting with nature, because when people think about games, they think about, oh, you're like Stranger Things, you're sitting in your basement, you're avoiding nature, but you're doing the opposite.
Yeah,
you're trying to bring games to nature.
I'm really,
and I think that's so important.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought up Metatopia. So I was sponsored to go to Metatopia as the IGDN, one of those, in 2017, and it was
cool.
No pun intended, a game changer for me, because I was like, oh, people, this is a serious medium. Like people take this really seriously and it can be really transformative. And up until like even through that convention, I had been writing LARPs and designing games for my day job. Right. It was all in the service of the company. And that's still a big bulk of my work. And then I realized, oh, I have a real passion actually for nature connection and guiding people to nature connection. And there was a marketing pitch panel that I went on where one of the things that I mentioned in my pitch, because there was like this whole thing, Jason Pete ran it with Beth Rimmel and a couple other people, forgive me, I can't remember their names, but he asked me to pitch my fake pitch to everybody. And I remember one of the things that I said in it is that people are afraid of connecting with nature because they think they're going to be bad at it, but it's not like a skill set in that way. It's not like an achievement that you like fail or don't fail to unlock. It's actually something that everyone carries with them. And sometimes
it's a relationship that you build.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And it can always be nurtured no matter like where you're at, literally geographically where you're at, but also where you're at in terms of your relationship to the natural world. It can always be nourished and grown, and it can always thrive. And some people,
so nice.
I find it very, like, I really believe this. And I believe it partly because like I've seen it. And people who work in games and who design games a lot, I think they feel a lot of alienation, partially because of that whole thing of like, oh yeah, I'm a nerd, I don't go outside. But but games can guide them there, right? They just need a gateway to be walked through. And then they're there.
Yeah, this resonates with me so much. Okay, I'm going to come clean.
yeah, please do.
Well, historically, I've always considered myself an indoor kid. So a part of that was that I've had really bad allergies growing up, up until like maybe I was like 22, to be honest.
Yeah.
But I couldn't go out for recess. I remember that during elementary school. My allergies were just so bad. And so, yeah, I've always had this weird relationship with the outdoors. And that's something that games has always provided me.
Yeah.
That gateway to being able to have that relationship. So a lot of what you're saying resonates with me so much.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad. That's so lovely.
As an adult, yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, Daniel. I'm going to cry.
I can, like, hear it. Oh, this is so sweet. This is so wholesome.
Aww.
I love it. Yeah. No, and,
work,
like.
Yeah, honestly, your work sounds super important.
Thank you.
And we're running out of time.
Yeah.
And I wanted to end with one question. So,
oh, yeah. Totally.
On that same trip where I was, you know, when I was. We were talking about that botany app in China.
Mm-hmm.
When I was flying home, and I watched this movie on the plane, called Survival Family. Mm. Have you ever seen it? It's a Japanese movie.
I haven't. What's it about?
So it came out in 2017.
It's super fringe.
Super fringe.
I googled it.
Now we're looking at it right now. It's so tiny.
It's got a 3 sentence. Man, 3 sentence like plot line summary. But so I watched this movie while on a plane back from Shanghai, and it like everything about this at this point, you know, 1 hour, 1.5 hour conversation that we've had, is kind of covered in that movie.
I hope it's on Netflix because I want to watch it immediately. Yeah. That's so cool.
Yeah, I hope it's on Netflix or on the Pirate Bay or something like that. not that I said that. but 100%, like, watch that movie. And I think it's really interesting. You have to watch it from like a culturally relative perspective because it really does play off of those traditional family values in Japan.
Absolutely,
And how those are completely uprooted by the loss of electricity.
Mm. Wow, yeah.
And there's this, and I'm no spoilers, but there's this like the stereotypical like husband, businessman, you know, blue collar worker.
Yeah, like a salaryman kind of,
Yeah, salaryman, that's the term. And when the electricity goes out, he continues to go to the office in the hope that he could continue his work.
Oh,
it's the saddest thing.
That's so real.
Yeah.
Right.
God. And, yeah.
Right. And it's a really good movie. And I think anybody who has fully listened to this episode of Asians Represent should watch this movie because I think it really, you know, it encapsulates how that feeling of disconnect that we sometimes have with nature, but the reality that we're always connected to nature.
Yeah.
That's what that movie's about.
Oh my God.
That's what I have to watch this.
Yeah. We have to watch this and then talk about it.
I would love to. I know that like there's like a time limit, but I would love to continue this conversation with you guys.
Let's do it. Yeah, like, let's do a part two.
Surface. Like even as we're talking, I've been thinking about like, another game I wrote called Your Dead Friend, and I was telling a very much non-LARPer friend of mine about it, and he was like, it's very interesting to me how much you use grief as the root for nature connection in this game. And on the one hand, I kind of hate it because I wish people could just like look outside and feel connected, but on the other hand, like that's how you open them up to feel how sacred that connection is, to feel how much they are already present in it. And that's actually very clever. Which I was like, why, thank you. I hadn't thought of that. I totally
planned that.
That was on purpose. But also like when he was talking about it, it made me kind of reflect on like my relationship with grief and how close to grief I felt like even since I was a kid. And I think that actually has a lot to do with my identity as a Korean American, as a Korean person. Like there's, you know, this is, again, one of those things that I hesitate to talk about in the presence of white people, but there's that idea of like Han when you're Korean, of this like in your blood as a Korean person is that knowledge that you are powerless. Like you're actually pretty powerless in the face of a lot of circumstance, but that doesn't mean you can stop fighting. And in Korea, it's actually like people die of Han. Even in Western medical practice in Korea, like you will see diagnoses of like, oh, this person had their fifth heart attack because they're just like so wrapped up in their Han. And so like the ways in which being diasporic as an Asian person is also kind of like there's an undercurrent that's wrapped into a lot of the ways that I feel in nature, like when I'm in nature. You know, like one of the most land connected memories I have of being a kid and being in nature is when my family would do our trip, our day trips out into the mountains in Korea to picnic at my grandfather's grave. Because in Korea, if you have a lot of money, you're not cremated. And like on one side of my family, I think my grandfather had a lot of money. You're buried in mudang. They're like these funerary mounds that the grass and the plants all grow over, and it's maintained by the family. And then you like go out to like pay your respects once a year. And it's a hike. Like you have to hike up a mountain, and there's like all these animals and all these plants and all these insects all around you. And then you spend the whole day out there and you come back. But all of that is on the back of like someone's death, like an ancestral death. Right. But it was still, you know, all of my memories of those days are really lovely. Right. So yeah, there's just so much to talk about.
Right. Like,
we will 100% do this again.
Please. I would love that.
There's so much media that we need to watch.
My last recommendation about connecting with nature, Hunt for the Wilder People.
Ooh.
If y'all haven't seen that
one. I have not.
It's by Taika Waititi, who did Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah, yeah. He's also in What We Do in the Shadows, I think. He's like
he also directed and wrote that movie.
Oh, did he? That's awesome.
Yeah, pretty sure.
That's awesome.
But he has another movie with the great Sam Neill, who was Dr. Alan Grant in Jurassic Park 1.
Yeah.
And Park 3. He's also in Event Horizon.
Oh, yeah. Do you guys follow Sam Neill's Instagram?
No.
Sam Neill, in his semi-retirement, has bought like a giant vineyard and land in New Zealand. And one of his passions are like his ducks and his livestock. And so he posts these little videos of like all his ducks like waddling around after him and his goats and stuff. He also loves the land. It's
pretty sweet. You know who loves the land? Chris Pratt. Have you seen Have you seen Chris Pratt's Instagram? So he bought a farm.
Nice. Excellent.
And he's been farming and he's like a lot of his videos are him introducing his son who he co-parents with Anna Faris. Like introducing his son, taking care of their goats and their animals. And he posted about he posted a picture of they had harvested meat from one of their animals and it was done very ethically.
Yeah.
And there was so much backlash against him in the comments, and people were like, "Oh, you're a monster." But he was trying to teach his son that, like, you know, this is where your food comes from.
Yeah,
right.
And, you know, so he's actually trying to do exactly what you're talking about with his family. And he's trying to make sure that his son stays connected with nature.
Yeah.
And that's really cool. So if the listeners want to get connected to nature through your games, where can they find you online? Where can they find you on Twitter, your website, your games?
Yeah, I'll throw up all the links in the chat here. But I do have a Twitter. It's just my name, Gian Shim, which – I am not going to assume that everyone will know how to spell from sound, so I'll put it up. I also have a Patreon now, which isn't super active.
It's not late
yet. I'll send that link as well, and then I'll send a link to Trackers Bay. And gosh, I'm actually doing a lot of things right now. I can also send individual links. For example, I don't have like a shop website yet for my LARPs, but they're all PDFs, and so I often list them in my Twitter feed, and I can list individual links for like Your Dead Friend, which is a sliding scale of $2 to $5, and for Pin Feathers and Cloud Studies, which is free. And let's see, I'm also going to be working as sort of like a wilderness skills liaison on a blockbuster LARP on the West Coast called Event Horizon, where this game is going to be, it's going to be survival themed.
So if we ever make it to the West Coast for Big Bad Con or something, we're going to have to chill.
Yes.
I really want to talk to you about survival, because it's something that I'm really into.
Yeah.
Like I keep like a bug out bag in my car. I could live in my home right now for 4 months without leaving.
Yep.
Yo, that's than I could do right now. I am very impressed. That's awesome.
Like I'm pretty hardcore.
Yeah, he is.
Good.
I'm a big advocate. You know, maybe, I have my fingers crossed. I'm really into like my everyday carry. Like I carry like a multi-tool and a knife with me everywhere I go. Yeah. I always carry a first aid kit.
Battery packs.
Battery packs. I carry everything. Everybody thinks I'm so weird because I carry a knife.
Yeah, but you're going to be chilling when...
I'm going to be chilling when the zombies come.
Do you have a life straw?
Y'all know.
I do have a life straw.
Yeah.
I also have a UV one as well.
Nice. Because the thing about the standard life straw.
Tell me what a life straw.
Life straws are great.
Life straw is like a portable filter that you. A straw. Gotcha, yeah. You can get them for $11.99 on Amazon.
Yeah, and they actually are quite effective. They will not necessarily purify water, but they do filter out most bacteria and impurities. So, for example, if you like come upon a water source in an urban area and you're not sure if it's like chemically tainted, they won't be as useful. But if it's like to protect against
Giardia,
things like that, it's good for that.
That's just crazy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it's like 99.9999 effective. So like it's pretty good.
If you're going to have anything in your like kit, you should have a life straw.
Yeah.
Low profile. So just
it
put
is
it in
low
there.
Profile.
No, they don't take.
Yeah. It's like the size of an EpiPen.
Yeah. And as long as you dry. So one thing to know about them is like you need to dry out the components after you use them because they can mildew. Yeah, it's like a filter. Right. But as long as you do that, they will last you a long, long time. And you can buy multiple and have them on hand. Yeah, they're useful. They're very useful, especially given the size, like how portable they are.
Yeah, and if you're going to carry a knife, I carry a Benchmade.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's good.
I have one folding knife for every day of the week.
That's awesome.
They're accessories, but I only carry one. I carry a Benchmade Mini Griptilian.
Yeah.
And I have a Leatherman Micra signed by Tim Leatherman himself.
Ooh, that's fancy.
That's my Tuesday knife. No.
Our workhorse knife at Trackers is the Mora Knives, the Swedish.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because they're.
I have one in my car.
They're great. They're fixed
weight.
Yeah, carbon steel is great for if you need.
Super light.
Yeah, if you do a lot of carbon steel is great because it means you can sharpen the edge back really well. But if you think your knife is ever going to get wet or you're not great at knife maintenance, then the stainless steel is really great. And what's great about the Morneve is it's like a sturdy fixed blade knife that we can use to like baton like wood, right?
Yep.
So it'll hold up to quite a lot. They're not expensive. No, they're not. And so they're great. And I strongly prefer them over even like a very good quality, like hinged folding knife, because as soon as you put a hinge in there, it's just the structural integrity. You can't baton with it. Exactly.
Well, you can actually baton with the Benchmade Mini Griptilian.
Oh my god,
one of the only folding knives that you can baton with.
Dang.
Reasonably.
I didn't know that.
Reasonably. Yeah, and I mean the fixed blade knife, like I have a Mora in my car, but under my bed in my bed kit I have a Gerber LMF2, and I picked it because it has a glass breaker on one end and a rubberized handle so you can cut wires.
That's a lot of useful. Yeah, I would love to see just if you want to take photos of your kit or like just send me a list of what's in your kit. I'd love to see it. Like what?
Yeah, 100%. We should do an episode. We should just talk gear.
Yeah, we should just talk gear.
We should just sit and talk doomsday.
Yeah, I feel like that will
be the live stream. We're just going
to
talk doomsday
and
share links.
Yeah.
Let's 100%. You know what? Let's leave it there and let's do that for a live stream because I think
that would be so cool. I feel like we have the bones for like at least two more like just recorded episodes like this, but being able to show people like this is what we have in our gear, that would actually be really cool. And coincidentally, I am writing a LARP about how to make a bug out kit and different scenarios.
Oh, nice.
Okay,
nice.
Let's do that.
Yeah.
Let's do that because I'm also going to be updating mine with some new things.
That's awesome. Nice. That's awesome. Great. Perfect.
Yo.
I'm so excited.
Let's do that.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's going to be great. So if people want to follow you on Twitter, I think Twitter is the best place to find all of your stuff.
Yes.
That's at Jeon Shim. Mm-hmm. So it's JEEYONSHIM for the people who aren't, you know, listening to this on the web and they're doing it through their phone.
Yeah. And what I'll do is I'll throw up a new pinned tweet that just has links to everything.
Perfect.
Until I get like a real website going. Yeah. And I have a Patreon.
You have
too.
A Tumblr.
I do have a Tumblr, although it is a little out of date. I'm trying to like revamp it, you know, now that the whole website is dead, RIP.
but
like for people who want, especially for people who want access to like glimpses of my work and PDFs of my games before they're published to the general public, my Patreon is actually the best place to find that.
And you'll find that on the Twitter. Thank you so much for doing this. Will be the first of many episodes.
I'm so excited. Thank you for having me. This was a really, really lovely way to spend my Tuesday evening. Thank you.
No, this was dope. All right. Well, have a good night.
You too.
Thanks to Gian for joining us for this episode of Asians Represent. And thank you, listener, for tuning in. Asians Represent is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. If you head to oneshotpodcast.com, you can listen to a variety of amazing podcasts like The Broadswords, an all-woman actual play Dungeons & Dragons podcast focusing on roleplay, narrative, and diversity at the gaming table. One day this year, we will do another collaboration with The Broadswords, and this time, we promise we will record it this time. Then there are only two people on the entire planet who witnessed the greatness of our first collaboration. Katie and Miriam, you are proof that this collab is going to be dope.
You're the ones who carried with you.
You're the ones carried in your hearts. But if you have any questions about this episode's theme, because we talked about a lot of different subjects, get in touch with us. You know, we talk a lot about being outdoors. I think this was the first episode where we really talked about not directly gaming related topics.
Yeah.
Right. But get in touch with us if you have any questions. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at AZNSRepresent or at AZNSRepresent@oneshotpodcast.com. We have an Instagram page at AZNSRepresent as well as a Facebook page. I'm Daniel.
And I'm Jade.
And you've just listened to Asians Represent.